Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett, and for your own safety, please do not attempt to listen to this radio program while operating supersonic or hyperactive type A machinery or while adjusting the knee pads, wrist guards, helmets, or other safety features mandated by state and federal regulations. Pregnant women, children under the age of 10, and anyone taking prescription medicine, please make sure you can locate the emergency exits. I mention this because we are all slowly going mad, trying to obey the flood of safety regulations, precautions, warning labels, and all the other devices that are meant to keep us safe. Of course it doesn't work. America's not safe. No one can open a bottle of aspirin anymore, but anybody can go out, buy a gun, and blow away the passengers on a subway car any time, no problem. So, what's wrong with this picture? Well, let's join producer Mary Beth Kirshner now on a subway in good old Tokyo.
The subways in Tokyo are probably best known for mercilessly packing commuters on trains, where rush hour is orchestrated by these pushers, cramming more and more people into each car. There's actually one subway platform in Tokyo where a train carrying 3,000 people pulls in every 90 seconds. Yet the scene is remarkably serene and orderly. The pushers, who wear white gloves, add an almost genteel atmosphere as they calmly insist while urging commuters into the trains. More people will fit, please make room, as they neatly tuck in stray arms or briefcases while the doors close. But that's not my most vivid impression of the subways of Tokyo. I lived in Japan for a few months and have a dramatically different, more lasting image of the Japanese subway. In select stations, they've installed aquariums at the entrances to the underground trains, some freestanding tanks, some built into walls with fairly nondescript collections of tropical fish. I've never seen anyone stop to look at them. They go unnoticed by most commuters. Yet the aquariums add a touch of tranquility to the stations for this blur of humanity that rush through them each day. But think about it. How long would an aquarium last in an American subway station? An American friend and I were sitting in a coffee shop in Tokyo when I began talking with her about these subway fish. We started laughing as we speculated about what might happen to them in America. Can't you just see an aquarium after one day in the New York subway, I asked. Beer cans resting on the bottom of the tank and graffiti all over the glass. Yeah, and the fish would all be dead, she said, each one individually stabbed. Maybe we'd become cynical after living in cities like New York and Washington, but that prediction certainly isn't so far-fetched. At the very least, it points to some major differences between the U.S. and Japan, which I've seldom heard discussed. Safety and crime in our two cultures. Quite simply, Japan is a very safe country, despite the fact that it's one of the most densely populated nations in the world, about 30 times the density of the U.S., it has one of the lowest crime rates in the world. If you compare violent crime per person in our two societies, the numbers are startling. The U.S. has over 5 times the number of homicides as Japan, 22 times more rapes, and 114 times as many armed robberies. How do those numbers translate to everyday living? Well, in Tokyo, it was quite tangible. I spent 4 months in Tokyo, a city of 10 million people, and would walk late at night by myself without hesitation. You'd see tiny children unescorted on the streets or on buses going to and from school. It's not as though there's no crime in Japan. People lock their cars and homes. Yet you'd never see something like the club on the steering wheel of a Japanese car. Some of the everyday precautions which we take here in America seem extreme by comparison.
Hi, we're going to Soho.
For example, a few weeks ago, I spent the day in Manhattan with a Japanese friend who's just moved to New York, and a short cab ride became an unexpected source of cultural self-exam.
He put this up, so he's protected. So no one can reach over and rob him. Mm-hmm.
My friend had never seen one of those plastic partitions between passenger and driver in a New York taxi, so she was quizzing me in our Haitian cabbie.
Maybe it's electronic bus.
Oh.
Why you cross?
Oh, you don't know New York City?
No. For you or for the customer?
For customer, for me.
I first met Hisako Nagao in Yokohama, Japan about 8 months earlier, as she was preparing to move to America with her two little boys.
Yokohama's a port. Seas over there.
She'd never even traveled outside Japan before her husband was transferred to New York by a large Japanese trading company.
I like baseball. Do you like baseball? Yes.
Back home
I
in
do.
Japan, she'd been I teaching like the boys baseball. A little English and encouraging them with stories of new playmates, but was basically terrified about the transition. Even though her husband had bought a home in suburban Connecticut, she was very worried about life in the U.S. and her children's safety.
My husband said I shouldn't have my children outside alone. He said, never put them outside by themselves, even their garden. Mm-hmm. Is that really thing?
You know, it's not.
It greatly saddened me to even hear such a question. Could she ever leave her kids alone, even in their own yard, to play?
Okay.
How would you have answered her?
And I think the only way you really know is to go and see what your neighborhood is like and to meet your neighbors and talk to other mothers.
Nagao is certainly not an extreme case. Many Japanese I met were very curious and very fearful about crime in America. I was regularly asked in Japan if I owned a gun in the U.S. or if I knew anyone had been killed. Most Japanese only know about American life from Japanese media, which typically depicts this country as a place where random violence is common and everyone is at risk of crime. The recent murders of Japanese exchange students in America have only heightened their fears. When exchange student Yoshihiro Hattori was killed in Louisiana while innocently looking for a Halloween party, some Japanese started to take action.
That tragic accident happened because of the ignorance of the word freeze. And we were so shocked. Okay, there must be other expressions we ought to know in order to protect our lives. And they came up with wanting to know more about it.
I met Mieko Hikosaka in Tokyo, where she'd been teaching a class in survival skills for Japanese traveling abroad. She and two colleagues started offering free seminars for families moving to America after the Hattori killing.
It is important to recognize what is being said to you. And we could think of some expressions that you can hear on the street. And also, even if, well, it takes time to be able to understand what is being spoken to you. So what can you do then to protect yourself? Maybe you need to say something to prove that you are innocent and you do not want to go against that person's wish, that you are obedient to whatever is requested. First, we thought that it is important to understand what is being spoken to you. For instance, not only freeze, but don't move, or hold it, or put your hands up, or spread them, or face down, or
how about the duck?
Oh yeah, duck. Duck was a new experience. Duck, or look out, or watch out, or drop it, or hand it over, or I mean it, I'm serious, that kind of things.
Hikosaka was overwhelmed with requests to enroll in her free classes. She anticipated 100 students at the first session, and 500 people showed. She's written a book about survival skills to meet the increasing demand for information about life in the West, which has grown with each new incidence of violent crime against Japanese in the United States. Yoshiko Higuchi has lived in America and teaches in Tokyo with Mieko Hikosaka about life outside of Japan.
I raised 3 points. One is protect yourself, because in Japan, you rely upon, we are more dependent with each other. So when you're not taken care of, somebody will take care of you. This is a so-called collectivism of the Japanese society. But the other world, especially in the Western world, you are individualism and more independent. So you have to care for yourself. And the second one is you have to be always alert. You can't be always relaxed. You can't be alert all the time, but little alarm lamp should be always on. You can't put it off completely. And the third one is stay informed. If you don't have enough information, you are very naive position, vulnerable. But you have, for example, if you know these examples and how and when, what situation crime can happen, then you can protect yourself.
About 3 million Japanese travel to the U.S. each year, many of them tourists, and over 50,000 exchange students. A recent New York Times CBS Tokyo Broadcasting poll found that 69% of Japanese responding thought they were very likely to be a victim of crime during a visit to the United States.
Japanese businessmen are quite vulnerable. When they get off at Kennedy Airport and taking a taxi to the center of New York, and at the end, arriving at a hotel, the taxi cab driver says, "Okay, sir, $300. And that businessman believes it and he pays. And why does it happen? Maybe here in Japan, we don't tell lies. We don't trick people so often. So we are used to being honest, because you never think of telling lies to other people, so you don't expect that other people may be telling lies to you, because I know once he tells lies to you, that person will get such a big shame and he will never have another job again. So our society is controlled with this shame feeling.
Sociologists and criminologists say this feeling of shame is one of the most important social controls in the Japanese culture. They say shame operates like an internal policeman within the individual and the Japanese society. Shame comes from the failure to measure up to group standards, as a powerful emphasis on the group in Japan, and to stray from the group, whether it be by telling a lie or committing a crime, brings shame not only to you but to everyone around you. Another powerful source of control is the homogeneity of the society. Cultural diversity is practically non-existent in Japan. Non-Japanese comprise less than 1% of the total population. Thus, the Japanese people and heritage have produced strong cultural traditions with consistent rules for behavior. By comparison, in the U.S., social scientists say our rich cultural diversity leads to uncertainty about social norms. Our heterogeneity weakens the sense of group, and our American values of freedom and individualism have resulted in a society where informal controls are weak. These are broad generalizations. However, they point to the differences in crime in our two societies as a reflection of significant differences in our cultures.
I often hear the visitors here in Japan, they are amazed at the fact that little kids walk in the train alone, get off the station alone, and go to school somewhere. Even the kindergarten children can ride on a bus and pay the ticket, and it is safe. And even at night, you see lots of children walking at night and using the public transportation, even at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, you often see it. And this is an amazing factor for most of the Americans.
You see, we have been brought up in this society, so we just don't realize how safe we are until we are told by foreigners who come and live and tell us their surprising stories. One of them was a man sent a shirt for laundry. And by accident, he just remembered later, "Oh, I forgot my 1,000 yen bill in the pocket." And a few days later, that shirt came back with a 1,000 yen bill ironed nicely, still in the pocket.
The stories may sound extreme, but I've heard countless others from Japanese and Americans alike.
When people say, "What's Japan like?" and I say, "Safe," they say, "Well, why do you say that?" And I always have subway stories.
Steve Spear has been on a fellowship in Tokyo for a year.
One had to do with a friend losing a wallet. He gets home without his wallet. He says, "Well, I'm never going to see that again. And he gets a phone call from Japan Rail saying, we have your wallet, but we really, really must apologize. So he's figuring, you know, everything's gone or something, right? And what they had done is someone had found this wallet, given it either to conductor. They stuck it on a train with one conductor, and he gave it to another conductor. And it was about three or four transfers until it got back to his home station. And the reason they were apologizing is because they were really, really busy right then, and they didn't have someone to take it home for him. And they were like, would it be a major inconvenience if you came to the station to get your wallet back? I guess the point is, when you live in a place that is as different from home as Japan is, and it is very different, what you're doing is holding up a very contrasting image of the life to which you're used to. It gives you an opportunity to examine everything, good and bad. I think you become very, very aware of how much noise and dirt, pollution, hostility, and violence that we just accept as Americans. You know, perhaps that's sort of a glib answer, because the solution to those things is not just a matter of saying, I won't take it anymore, you know, sort of like that Network movie. But that's part of it. You know, people just saying, you know, this is absurd. We're not going to put up with this, and we're going to figure out a solution.
Tom Pearson is as close to the Network model as you could find.
I could sense the difference the very first night I came in from the airport, riding on the bus and seeing people on the street, just walking without a care, without that sort of edginess or watchfulness that we take for granted in New York.
Pearson is a very successful American jazz musician living in Japan. He moved to Tokyo from New York about a year ago.
Then right after I got here, there's a somewhat well-known American bassist who lives here, Paul Jackson. He used to play with Herbie Hancock. So I went to see Paul do a concert in a park, and he left his bass, you know, 50 yards away on a park bench. And I said, Paul, your bass is like over there. He said, this is Japan.
He lived in New York most of his career, where he'd scored films for Woody Allen and Robert Altman. But he decided to leave Manhattan after he'd been the victim of violent crime multiple times. He says he knew he'd finally had it when some friends were held up at knife point in his apartment building.
We had buzzed them into the building, and they came up. You know, guess what just happened to us? A guy took a knife to us in the elevator, you know, took our money. So we, of course, called the police. And as I was sitting in the kitchen listening to the police take a deposition for my friends, I thought, this is it. I'm leaving.
For practical reasons, Pearson needed to be in a city with an active music business, and he chose Tokyo. American jazz musicians thrive here. Pearson speaks no Japanese. His piano playing is his primary means of communication, and it serves him well. American jazz is warmly received in clubs all over Tokyo. Pearson moved to Japan, never having traveled to Asia in his life, with only a few musician friends in Tokyo. He lives in a tiny one-room apartment, about 8 by 8 feet, with no shower. He goes to a coin-operated laundromat to shower each day, yet he thinks he's living in paradise.
I certainly don't care if I ever see New York again. You know, when I came here, I found that my whole outlook on life just improved so much. I could enjoy the simple things in my daily life. Oh, eating, sleeping. I mean, in a Tokyo Journal, they quoted that I said New York was a war zone. That just sort of slipped out. But that's the way I feel here, like I'd been in Vietnam and now I got out of it, you know. Well, it's interesting, in rhythm music or jazz music, there is something I would call street values. A lot of the language of the street is the same language that jazz musicians use. Rhythm music requires fast reflexes. It requires physical and mental acuity. So, in a way, these values are fostered by the street life. But I have no infatuation anymore with the street life. I don't think the street life is glamorous. I don't think danger is glamorous. Probably there are changes in my music that I'll observe a few years in retrospect. Maybe, I don't know if I am more productive, but I sort of feel more productive because I think I take a little bit more pleasure in my work here. Life here, maybe for many other people, and I feel it also, is very cyclical. So the regular rhythm of daily life, or even of the seasons, that can generate a kind of energy that's beneficial for your work.
After the last set, I met Pearson's bass player, Chin Suzuki. Pearson and Suzuki had played together in New York a few years back when Suzuki lived in the U.S. for a brief stint. He and I talked about Tom's move to Tokyo. Suzuki was a big supporter of Pearson's change in lifestyle, having lived in both countries himself. In Japan, he said, we live every day with a low-level fear of natural disasters like typhoons and earthquakes. You never know when one might happen. But in America, you live with a low-level fear of other people. Later that evening, as I walked home well past midnight, it was the music and conversation that were on my mind. I wasn't concerned about being on the streets of Tokyo on my own. There were other things to think about. I only had a few weeks remaining in my stay in Japan, and I decided that I was going to produce this radio documentary about crime and safety when I returned to America. Among other things, I thought I needed to gather some sounds indicative of crime in Japan, a siren at least. So I kept a tape recorder with me at all times. After a week, I'd almost given up before I finally stumbled across one. An ambulance. From what I could tell, the ambulance had been called to pick up someone at an office building who had a bad fall on the job. Not exactly what I'd been looking for. Nevertheless, it was perhaps a fitting conclusion to my search. Back in America, my friend Hisako Nagao had been settling down in suburban Connecticut.
My house is between Costco station and Riverside station, and my husband ride on train.
I paid her a visit when I returned, and she took me for a drive around her new neighborhood in Coss Cobb.
Now, how many Japanese do you think live in Coss Cobb? Do you know?
20 or 25 family, maybe. Because
25 other Japanese families in the area create more of a sense of community than she'd expected. There's even a Japanese market where she can shop for food from home.
Oh, noris, you can get that here.
Yes.
What else can you buy here that you can't get?
Sakurabi. Tiny shrimp, dried, and beans.
Of course, in Connecticut, very, very safety. If I forget to key, maybe nobody will enter in my house.
She told me how she'd been adapting to American life, relatively free of crime. Her family had just bought a new American car, and unfortunately the license plates were stolen only a week later, but she didn't seem too concerned. Among other stories, she told me that she and her family had recently gone to a Yankees game, where, despite warnings from her Japanese friends in Coss Cobb, she took the children to the public restrooms by herself. She was very pleased with her boldness, and she added with pride that she'd even gone to the concession stands on her own. Although her life in America may not be as safe as it was in Japan, it's not what she'd feared.
I must find out by myself. Now I think so, but when I lived in Japan, I thought every information correct, and I was very afraid of that. And now I can, sometimes I can find which is correct, which is incorrect. And if I cannot have a chance to live in America, maybe I have many prejudice about America, about the dangerousness of America.
As Hisako Nagao's definition of security is evolving, so is Tom Pearson's. He recently told me he'd seen someone attacked on the streets of Tokyo late one night while he was coming home from a gig and had to call the police. Never having met, the two of them are experiencing this strangely related reversal and understanding of our two cultures. Perhaps none of us had to travel quite so far for this sort of reevaluation of quality of life. Yet this cross-cultural mix with its taxicab and subway stories, typhoons and tropical fish provides an interesting prism through which to reflect on how and where we choose to live, and what we put up with, adapt to, or yearn for as we strive to be safe.
Japan is a Safer Place to Be a Fish was produced by Mary Beth Kirshner with associate producer Molly Murphy. The studio engineer was Robin Wise. Special thanks to George Kochi and the Asian Cultural Council. Support for this program was provided by the Hoso Bunka Foundation. Join us next week on Soundprint as we take you on a trip through the rubble of a Rust Belt metropolis.
I tried to bet and invest every dime I had to revitalize Braddock, but from the lack of cooperation and the pessimistic thinking that permeated some of the businessmen and some of the so-called leaders, the politicians of Braddock, I could not get any cooperation. Therefore, the negative thinking that permeated Braddock destroyed it.
That's Braddock, Pennsylvania, City of Magic, next week on Soundprint. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Special thanks to WVPN. Today's program is funded by the National Science Foundation. Additional support is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include, for coverage of technological innovations, the Lemelson Foundation, Investing in America's Economic Future. Write us with your ideas and comments. Write Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street, Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50. If you want to order with a credit card, you can call us at 202-885-1285. The number is, again, 202-885-1285. Our internet address is soundprint@american.edu. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria De Freitas, Studio Engineer Robin Wise, and Production Assistant Francesca Raymond. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett.